Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, who already joined us three times on episode 18, 61, and 83, and talked about the essential elements of washoku, the unique concept of ichimoku zenshoku and tsukushi kondate, and Japanese tsukemono pickles, and I learned so much from her on each episode. And Elizabeth is a food writer and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan since 1966. And she runs the culinary art program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. So check that out if you have planned to visit Japan. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from the Japanese Kitchen, which is available everywhere on Amazon and whatever. And today's topic is Japanese tableware, which is an important integral part of Japanese cuisine. For example, if we have a formal kaiseki dinner, each plate or bowl has a theme to feature the current season. And of course, seasonality is the foundation of Japanese cuisine. So today we'll discuss unique philosophy of behind Japanese tableware, different materials, shapes and prints, and how to use them, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Needs is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcast. So please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Needs, and please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have ideas about topic of the show or show guests, please let us know, and you can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or kikokatema.com. So now let's start our conversation with Elizabeth Sando. Hello.
Thank you.
Yeah, welcome back.
Thanks.
So what's the reason for you to come back to New York this time?
Various. I often come back in the fall, and today, suddenly, New York has turned to fall weather. When I first arrived, it felt like summer, and I wondered if I had come at the wrong time.
Or maybe you brought the fall.
Maybe I did, because fall has such wonderful tableware, among other things.
Right.
There are special dishes, but the themes, everything about the seasonality of fall, the Japanese often say that the fall is the most delicious time of year. Aki no mikaku, it's the time where all the really good foods are there. And interestingly, some of the chief foods have very special tableware that's intended only for that food.
Okay, so we're going to go into various those things. So the history of Japanese tableware goes back, I heard, to the 6th century, and the nobles and riches developed unique designs and styles, and also tea ceremony contributed to refining the Japanese tableware as well. So before we talk about them,
right.
How do you describe the typical Japanese meal compared to the typical Western meal?
I think one of the biggest differences is this notion of okazu, the numerous dishes. Typically, at least in America, and I think most Western cuisines, you find a single plate and lots of different foods are sort of heaped on top of it in no particular order or pattern. There doesn't appear to be any significant guidelines for how it gets done. In Japan, very often, each food is going to have its own vessel, and it's going to be chosen to highlight the food, to make it attractive and actually easier to eat. And they're arranged in a fair amount of space, often organized on a tray, but there are going to be lots of little dishes instead of one dish with lots of things on it.
So I think, you know, typically when we talk about Japanese meal, we say ichiju sansai, which I think goes back to Muromachi period of the 14th to 16th century. So basically one soup and three dishes accompanied by a bowl of rice. And I think that's the foundation. That's why. And then when I grew up, you know, I was asked to set the table and the miso soup on the right and the rice on the left and the, you know, okazu or the entree and the side dishes in the middle somewhere, like scattered around. And then so there's order. You have to dip your chopsticks in the miso soup at the beginning so that the chopsticks get wet, it doesn't stick to the rice doesn't, you know, stay on your chopsticks.
Right. And also drinking, if your throat is dry, your mouth is dry, it's very hard to taste food. And so unlike a Western table, again, where there's a glass of water there and you can take a sip of it, shiru or liquid is often just to wet your mouth, to also get ready to be able to taste other things that are there. But when I first went to Japan, clearly there was there seemed to be a reason why things were set the way they were, although it didn't make a whole lot of sense to me at the beginning. And this notion of kamiza, the exalted location, as the lower left, and that the rice bowl always had to be there because that was a sign of respect for rice, the people who grew the rice. And it didn't belong on the right-hand side. It seemed to me to be more logical to put the rice on the right, and I was always corrected. It was brought to the left, and the soup was always to the right. And truth be told, table setting is a bit of culture, and any culture is what the people who practice it decide it's going to be. You know, people ask why, and the answer is because.
Interesting. And I didn't know that, you know, kamiza, you know, rice is respected. And also, you know, I think it's, of course, everything's based on right-handed people. But, you know, you hold, if you're right-handed, you hold your rice ball on your left. And then that's kind of, you know, like a holder. When you reach with a chopstick, you may drop something. So rice ball catches whatever you may drop.
That's true. That's another difference that I hadn't realized until you mentioned it just now, that the Japanese actually hold the rice bowl and hold the soup bowl in their hands while they're eating, whereas in a Western table, the dishes stay put on the table, and you take with your knife and fork, and you bring it to your mouth. And in Japan, it's the other way around. You drink directly from the soup bowl. You don't have a spoon where you're scooping it up. And from the rice bowl, you're holding it up and being able to bring other things on top of it. It's actually so much easier once you get used to the Japanese way, I think. You don't make such a mess.
I think, you know, you've been raising a very interesting point of using knife and fork because you need both hands, so you never lift your plates or bowls. And also I heard that because you lift the bowl or the plate, it's smaller.
Yes, but also there's a feel to it. When I go to buy tableware, I will take it in my hand and I'll feel it. And if it doesn't feel right, even if I like the look of it, I probably won't buy it. I won't add it to my collection. There's a certain comfortable weight. If it's too lightweight, it doesn't feel right either. And interestingly, the mouth feel, or rather the lip feel, when you bring a soup bowl to your mouth, wood or lacquer coated wood feels very different.
Mm.
I remember when I went to Kanazawa for the first time many years ago to do some research on lacquerware and how it was made, and being surprised the first time I ate ice cream with a lacquer spoon.
Mm.
It tasted different because it wasn't the spoon wasn't cold. It felt sort of silky and velvety. And soup, it's nice when it's hot, but it doesn't hurt your lips to hold a right. Japanese soup bowl up to your mouth and drink from it. So it feels very different.
Mm, right, because, oh, that's interesting, because you hold it, you put it onto your mouth too.
Right.
So that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just a spoon thing, wooden spoon.
Right.
I personally purchased one really nice one.
Right.
I mean, it's not expensive, but right. it just fits me.
Right.
So that's almost the only spoon I used ever since.
Yeah, metal instruments, utensils, feel very different in your mouth. They conduct heat and cold, and it's almost shocking to the food. You don't get a chance to taste the food the way it should be. And chopsticks and other wooden utensils, I think, are more gentle. Mm. They allow the flavor of the food to be enjoyed.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and also I think because you hold the bowl, you know, the side design
yes.
of, you know, bowls
right.
becomes more important, not just the inside, too.
Also, very interestingly, many bowls are, when the tray is set, turned upside down, and then you turn it around and ask somebody to fill it with the rice.
Mm.
So it's not filled with the rice necessarily when you get to the table.
Mm.
And so many rice bowls, the design is on the outside.
Ah, that is true.
And when you flip it over, there may or may not be something on the inside, but the outside is what you see first.
Right.
And I know during classes when I'm teaching in Tokyo, too, I have a drawer that has only rice bowls in there, and people can pick out the one that they want.
Mm.
And often they comment on the fact that when they turn it over, there's nothing on the inside.
Mm. Right. Well, we talk about, you know, how to buy the Japanese table later, but yeah. you know, like so many great, fun designed
yes.
tableware. If you go to department stores, just like, you know, corner store, you right. can spend easily half an hour at the store.
Yes, I always have to set myself a budget when I walk in. Yeah, that's hard.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about materials, because I think, you know, knife and fork. We don't use knife and fork, so I think the Japanese table can be more fragile. Because you're not going to break it with metal, so...
No, you're not going to scratch it with a knife or a fork.
Right.
But there are different surfaces, and I think the Japanese enjoy that textural difference.
Mm.
So sometimes you have porcelain, which is very smooth and glass-like, and sometimes you have very rough pottery, including unglazed pottery, like you would get at, you know, Bizenware.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the natural moisture of the food can be somewhat absorbed into the pottery itself. And sometimes you have to be a little careful when you first buy them. You have to sort of prepare them for having food put in them. And usually the way to do that is to actually give them a bath in togijiru, the rice water, the runoff water from washing rice, is starchy in a very wonderful way. It has just a little bit of the natural rice oils in it.
Mm.
And so when you give it a hot bath, it coats the inside of the dishes.
Okay.
And then it won't get stained with the food that you put in afterwards. And it gives it a nice gloss to it as well.
Right. I think in the last episodes you told me about the secrets of togijiru.
Yes. Right. Well, I think it's liquid gold. And people who throw out the water from washing rice. People who don't wash rice, I think, are missing out on good tasting rice.
Mm.
And people who then don't save the togijiru, I think they're missing out also.
That's an interesting point, because I think in the States, you're not encouraged to wash it because it's, you know, the nutrition.
But you're not really losing nutrition. You're losing starch.
Mm-hmm.
And that starch can be used for other things.
Right.
But it gets in the way. It interferes with the flavor of the rice when you're trying to cook it. It gets it gummy and sticky.
Right. Yeah. So regardless where you are, you wash it and they use the togijiru. That's right. A better way to
do it. Yes, I think so.
Okay. Yeah. So what kind of materials are used to make Japanese tableware?
All sorts. Almost always things that are natural. different kinds of clay, and depending upon where in Japan. Japan's a relatively small country, but the various different kinds of clay, there are hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of clay depending upon where you are.
Mm.
Some of it is more volcanic than others, certain minerals in them, and that will dictate to a large extent the way in which the finished dish is made.
Mm.
Most people who are into food in Japan have a fair knowledge of the different kilns, the different places that make pottery in Japan,
mm.
and will often specify, for example, bizen, the unglazed, is rather, the Japanese word jimi, rather subdued,
mm-hmm.
But it makes food look gorgeous.
Mm. It's almost like a wabi-sabi.
Yeah, but it really makes, rather than a bright dish, it makes the food look so much more beautiful.
Mm.
And then sometimes you want, hagi has a sort of a gray and white chalky sort of look to it, and that might be just the thing for a bright colored tomato salad.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to make it look better. So you would pick and choose depending upon what you were, the effect that you wanted. Sometimes you want contrast, sometimes you want a monotone.
Mm.
And different textures, different colors, all through different clay that's available.
Mm-hmm.
Leaves and different kinds of wood, particularly bamboo, is used a great deal.
And also lacquerware.
Lacquerware, mm-hmm. yeah.
So, yeah, I went to see, demonstration by lacquer, the craftsman.
Right.
It's amazing.
Truly amazing. How do people figure that out?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are so many processes. And the lacquer itself is like sap from a tree, and it can be very irritating to your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So the people who first followed through on that idea, I mean, they must have had itchy hands and all sorts of other problems, but realized that it was worth doing again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not quite sure, but it's amazingly durable. And again, the mouth feels, particularly if you're going to be taking that either utensil, the chopsticks, or the bowl to your mouth,
mm.
it just feels so different.
Mm-hmm.
It makes the experience of eating different.
Right. And for like New Year's special, bowl, ozoni,
yes.
used to have a really beautiful, bowl, lacquerware bowl, and it feels special.
Yes, it is. And it's a slightly different shape. It's thicker, actually, at the bottom than it is at the part that where your
mm.
lips are, so that it's not difficult. You don't have to keep your mouth uncomfortably open.
Mm.
It's just slightly open to drink it, but there's a certain weight to the bowl. Yes, we have separate ozoni bowls also.
Yeah. So, okay. And so you mentioned also, it's not that concept of set of 12 doesn't exist in Japan, not so
no.
many. And usually it's mixed and match.
A lot of mixed and match. Five, if there were a set, it's probably going to be five. Almost never four. The number four tends to be avoided in Japan.
Because four means
death. people who say, huh? I remind them of the 13th floor in America. It's
mm.
really there. It's just called 14. People don't like to call it 13.
Mm-hmm.
But if at all possible, you avoid the number four. And when you can't avoid it, then you have two sets of two or three in one.
Mm.
But you never really group them as obviously four. Sometimes there are three things down on the plate and you'll put one in the middle on top of it, almost
mm.
like a little pyramid. And it's really four things,
right.
but it doesn't look like four.
So and probably Japanese tableware or the culture tend to prefer even number for...
I think odd numbers more. Five very definitely is the norm in Japan. And it's interesting because the seasons are four seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So there are many pieces of tableware where the set are different motifs from each of the seasons, and
mm-hmm.
there's only four of them. So what are they going to do with the
right.
fifth?
Right.
Various yeah. different ways of accommodating that.
Mm-hmm. So I meant odd numbers.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because, the otoso,
right.
New Year's
right.
cups never be four.
No, they're only
five. The three.
So usually at New Year's, it's the shochikubai, the pine, the plum, and the bamboo.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got tsurukame,
mm-hmm.
The symbols of longevity, the tortoise and the crane. Mm. And so the combination is five, but it's the three friends of winter.
Right.
And then you've got the two sort of special celebratory ones that are set of five. But increasingly in Japan, too, there is open stock so that you can purchase as many as you want.
Okay, that's more practical.
And sometimes the set is also the same pattern, but different colors. So there's the five colors, red, yellow, green, black, and white.
Mm.
And that would be a set by the Japanese notion of a set.
Right. Yeah, the five colors for health. That's another foundation of Japanese cuisine.
Indeed.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and also, like, you know, the seasonality we a couple times mentioned already. So how is seasonality expressed in Japanese tableware?
One of the things that I like, although it does increase the need to have more dishes in your cupboard, is the fact that there are certain foods that have their own dish.
Mm.
And in the fall, there's two, samma, which is a long, narrow fish.
Mm.
And indeed, long, narrow plates are useful year-round, but you can't really comfortably put this long, narrow fish, unless you're going to cut it in half, on anything but a long, narrow plate.
Mm.
And the plate is called samma sara, samma zara, or the samma plate, even though it's used for other things. And then there's a wonderful, it looks like a teapot, but it's not really, called a dobin.
Mm-hmm.
And the dish is dobin mushi and mushrooms. And the fall is just wonderful mushrooms. If you have access and money for matsutake, the pine mushrooms, they're wonderful. But pretty much any kind of mushroom is going to be wonderful steamed in this teapot. And it produces a broth that you drink in a little cup.
Mm-hmm. So there's a pot and there's a lid, and then on top there's a cup to
pour. A little tiny cup, yeah. And so you stuff it with, you line it with kombu, because kombu always makes things taste better, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you stuff it with lots of mushrooms and a little bit of either water and or water and sake, usually a combination of the two, maybe a pinch of salt, and you steam it. And as you're steaming it, it produces a liquid, and you drink the liquid. The broth is delicious. And then you can eat all the bits and pieces out of the pot.
Afterwards.
Right. Right. And some people put seafood in there. Some people put chicken in there as well.
Mm.
But just mushrooms are right. wonderful.
Like you said, in matsutake, you know, it's in the season. It's like a truffle of Japan. And when I see dobin mushi, oh, wow, it's fall.
Yeah, it really is. And I just switched over my kitchen culture page on my website. And if people go there, they can download a recipe for it.
Oh, really?
So if you go to tasteofculture.com and look at the kitchen culture page and click on that, you'll see a lot of information about dobin mushi, including some pictures of different ones. And then there's a recipe you can download for.
Cool. So I'll put the links to on our show page.
Good.
And I think I want our listeners to see what dobin mushi is. Pretty much the summary of Japanese food culture.
It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
Mm. So other thing I think is unique about Japanese concept, that's, you know, the plating.
Right.
It's unique, like, you know, I think I started to see in Western shows a huge plate, and just on the one side there's a little bit of appetizer, the kind of plating.
Right.
So
the notion of nothing being something, and making that part of the design, the Japanese refer to it as yohaku, and it's not filling the plate. It's almost what's not filling the plate is as much a part of the central design as anything else. In the formal kaiseki meal, there's a course, the hasun course, where typically there's just two, possibly three things that are located in this larger space, but it's
so hasun. Basically, it's the name hasun is a measurement, 24 centimeters, and I think like 4 inches, a square.
Right. It's a square,
right?
Yeah,
it's a huge plate, but only place only two things.
And usually it's something umi no sachi, something from the waterways, and yama no sachi, something from the land.
Mm-hmm.
and not always one than the other, but usually one is upper right and the other is lower left, mm-hmm. and the rest of the space is not filled. So it's the positive use of negative space. Mm. And I think that it was very intriguing to a lot of Western chefs, mm. and they played around with it.
Right, because if there is a black, you have more of a white, the same idea of this a blank, you understand right. there's something there.
Right. Mm. And some people think it's because there might be a design on the plate that you don't want to cover with food so people can see it. That's rarely the case. This notion of yohaku, of this mm-hmm. negative space being used positively, is nothing filling that space. It's the fact that it's blank mm-hmm. that makes it attractive and makes the food, your eye look more at the food and appreciate it mm-hmm. for what it is.
So maybe that's the minimalist, less is more.
I think idea. So, yeah.
Mm. And also, you know, one thing that, like, if you just have a sashimi, you know, depending on where you go, kind of how many dishes, right. or how many pieces of fish you have, there's a flow of, yes. you know, how do you cut it and how make a flow, or just that centered around or scattered around.
It's almost like a landscape. Mm-hmm. And typically, things are going to be higher, taller in the back and lower in the front. And I guess you could liken it to, especially if it's fish, a stream swimming in mm-hmm. the foreground. Right. And you've got maybe a hill or a grassy mound in the background, maybe even a mountain,
right.
Depending upon how thinly you can slice your daikon and make it into one of these very tall mountain-like right. mounds and not have it fall apart on you. Mm. There's a skill to that, but it's hard to describe on radio.
Well, just, you know, there's a word shake, right? Shake is like you can't own that view, but you see that view from the nature as if it's yours.
Yes.
So it's kind of summarized on the plate, like, you know, the higher side looks like a mountain and the lower side is like yes. ocean. That kind of right. things really summarize them.
It's also interesting that there's a particular point of view, and that point of view is the person who's eating. It's not symmetrical. It doesn't look the same mm-hmm. from other places. There's a very special view from where the diner is sitting. Mm-hmm. And I think that perhaps is different too. Other cuisines, especially those where you might share it, you know, it's one of the round tables that's being rotated around, it has to look good from all angles.
Mm.
Whereas very often for Japanese food, it's a very specific point of view.
Mm.
And creating that point of view for the person who's going to be eating.
Right. Right. Right, you never make a mistake on serving. You never be served with the wrong side.
No, you wouldn't.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about unique bento boxes which you may want to use for your lunch. So please stay with us.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Whole Foods Market believes in seeking out local, fresh, and seasonal food, and in supporting local farmers, makers, and the community as a whole, economically and agriculturally. Whole Foods Market believes in food that is vivid and colorful, fresh and full of nutrients. Food that connects you to your body, the seasons, and to nature. Food that helps you do more, sleep better, and wake up happier. Found in over 400 locations throughout the United States, Whole Foods Market only sells food that meets their standards, which means no artificial colors, flavors, preservatives, or sweeteners, ever. Whole Foods Market believes in real food. Visit WholeFoodsMarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, and my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, a food writer and cookbook author and Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So now let's talk about bento box.
Okay. I think it's interesting that a box is obviously portable, and probably it began needing to carry food from one location to another. But the various different styles of boxes, whether they're layered or stacked, or whether it's a single layer, and whether they're divided up, there's all different kinds. And there are some occasions where certain ones are expected, for example, a jubako, the stacked ones at New Year's time, and whether you've got two layers, three layers, four layers, five layers even, and you can pass them around. They're very practical, and one layer on top of the other sort of forms a lid. There's only a single lid for the whole stack, but when you open it up, you can pass around the different layers, and it's almost like passing around a platter. The way in which you divide that space changes somewhat with the geography of Japan. The folks in the Kansai area down in Kyoto and Osaka tend to arrange food slightly differently than the people up in Tokyo, the old Edoko style. I think the Tokyo area tends to be more geometric. It looks almost like a mandarin painting, the way in which it's sectioned off, whereas down in the Kansai area it tends to be more flowing, less contained in there. And within the single layer boxes, the most sort of classic is something called a shokado bento, which is four sections. We just spoke about four not being a great number, but one is always rice, so it's three in one.
It's like, you know, there's the cross in the middle and they divide into four sections.
And there's no hard and fast rules about what belongs in the other three. The rice belongs in the lower left. But usually those things that might be challenging to eat would be in the lower right, because they don't have to travel as far with your chopsticks, because you wouldn't pick up the whole box.
Right.
Sometimes inside inside the box, there might be small dishes that you could lift up individually. But usually if there's something difficult to eat, it's going to be in the lower right. But otherwise, nimono is going to, things that are simmered are going to be probably clustered together. Things that might be fried would be clustered together. There might be an arrangement of tempura. And there might be various different aimono, things that are tossed together in another section. And it's a great way of organizing an entire meal, but in a single container. For the person who's preparing it, there's two challenges and two advantages. The challenge is to be able to make food that is can be served at room temperature. You can't put anything terribly hot or terribly cold in a box. It has to be good at room temperature. And that's also one of the advantages, that indeed you don't have to worry about last minute heating things up or making sure that it's very chilled.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, for the osechi, the Japanese New Year's food is made, I think probably because housewives don't have to work the first 3 days of the year. So it's temperature safe. You don't have to heat anything. And that's one thing. And also, you know, that since you say that's on top, there's one lid. So you open it, it's just so many colors.
Yes.
And you know, kind of like hold your breath, like, wow, how beautiful is it?
It really is like a canvas on which you're making a painting. And I think that's perhaps one of the things that got me really intrigued. Many, many years ago, here in New York, I was at the High School of Music and Art as an art major. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I often think that one of the ways of getting the artistic sensibility of me is being able to paint this picture on the canvas. And then the fact that you can serve it and eat it and people can enjoy the taste of it is yet another pleasure that comes with it.
And also I see sometimes on Facebook, there's a crazy, you know, mother's bento for kids, a very good competitive, like a panda or Hello Kitty to everything.
Well, this whole, the karaben, these characters and being able to paint. Interestingly, nori, the sheet of laver sea, people say it's seaweed, it's not really weed, but that's used to roll sushi, mm-hmm. can be cut with scissors, mm. and you can make stencils out of them.
Right.
And so there are these very elaborate sort of shadow cuttings that are then laid on top of rice, and you get these very elaborate.
Right. You get up like 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, yeah.
Assemble. Right. Yeah, and I heard that there is a my favorite type of bento box, that's called the magewappa.
Uh-huh.
And I heard it's becoming more popular. So magewappa, basically, it's a, you know, it's a cedar or cypress or some thin wood and boiled to very higher temperature. So it's easier to, you know, bend.
Right.
And then you use very technical craftsmanship to make it.
It's incredible. I took a trip to the Tohoku, and the Tohoku region is known for its magewappa,
mm-hmm.
And was actually at the studio of one of these craftsmen, and completely amazing. Again, whoever thought to do that.
Mm.
It's interesting that it's similar almost to making a musical instrument like a violin or a cello that curves, and apparently the technology is fairly similar. I'm not all that familiar with how musical instruments are made, but some of the closures on the magewappa, there are no nails. It's woven.
Wow.
So it's the edges are cut and woven into each other. And some of them are also lacquered on the inside.
Wow.
They're really beautiful. And slightly high maintenance, but definitely worth it.
Mm.
You have to be sort of careful. They're not something you can put in the dishwasher.
Right.
Never. And not even the rough side of a sponge. You'd have to be fairly careful with it. But they're gorgeous. And the aroma, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Very often, whether it's bamboo or various different woods that are in the cedar family, they have an aroma to them that is hard to describe, but makes the food taste better.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, sometimes, you know, sake's wooden cup can be too harsh, but, you know, wooden bento box is so much more subtle, and I like the smell that gets to rice.
Yes. And in the old days, there were woven reeds for bento boxes as well, especially in the summer, to allow air to get through.
Okay.
There's all sorts of wonderful paraphernalia sold nowadays for bento boxes, and also the cloth to wrap them in that then becomes sort of like a placemat afterwards.
Mm.
Yeah.
So this is kind of a slight deviation, but, you know, one of the main items for bento is onigiri, right?
Yes.
And lately there's a crazy invention called onigirazu.
Right.
Do you know what it is?
It originated in manga, the world of manga, and Cooking Papa was the manga, and it's a comic book about a single father who was making lunches for his kid. And rather than, I'm not sure it really takes any less time and effort, but he spread out a sheet of nori, and he placed some rice on it, and then took the edges and folded them over, pressed it down to make a little package out of it, and then cut it in half. And when you do that, it looks almost like a sandwich.
Right.
And instead of bread, you've got the nori on the outside, and then you've got your filling on the inside. They can be very elaborate, and really interesting designs can be made depending upon the angle at which you put the rice to the square of the nori.
Yeah. And so I gave one to my friend, and I saw, you know, the whole family using it, so I got one for myself.
Wow.
And it's really, I think the advantage is your hands are not so sticky with rice pieces of rice.
Right.
And then also you can put quite a, you know, bulky, substantial thing and pack it so nicely.
Definitely more rice goes into nigirazu, and the nigiru means to compact, and nigirazu means you don't have to do that, which means you don't have to shape it in your hands. Mm-hmm. You're still compacting it, but it's instead you're just putting weight on top of it. You're flattening it out.
Yeah. So I think it's, you know, for kids who may be interested in cooking, making something, it's like, it's just fun to...
It's a lot of fun, yes.
So it's onigirazu. So
yes.
I should be commissioned by that. It's really fun. So anyway, so what about chopsticks? That's another important piece.
My chopstick collection. chopsticks are so useful. As a matter of fact, each time I come back to America and I'm presented a salad with a knife and a fork, I just don't know how to eat them. How can you spear a piece of lettuce with a fork and get it in your mouth without getting everything all over you? It's so much easier to pick it up with chopsticks to sort of pluck it. But chopsticks have been part of the table setting in Japan from... The picture, when often I do slide presentations, there's a picture of a 12th century banquet that indeed has this huge bowl of rice on the lower left and lots of little things behind it. And then actually there are condiments or flavorings, seasonings to the right. And at that time, the 12th century, there was still a spoon, but it wasn't for like soup. It was for scooping up things like salt and other condiments that you were going to place on your food. So... It certainly chopsticks date back at the Japanese table at least that old and probably a whole lot older than that. They're always to the left, whether you're a righty or a lefty. But, you know, when people don't stop to think about it when they set a table in America, whether you're right-handed or left-handed, the fork goes to the left and the knife goes to the right. Why? Because. That's the way you do it. And you can switch... hands afterwards, but when you're setting the table, that's the way the table is set. Right. And the chopsticks are set down towards the diner. They're horizontally, they're not vertical.
Right.
They're always horizontal, and the tips that would go in your mouth are always pointing towards the rice bowl.
Right. Yeah, it's always. And it just creates a flow on the table.
It does, and it's inviting. It urges you to pick them up and to start eating.
Right.
But chopsticks can be made primarily of different kinds of wood and lots of different designs, patterns, colors. And again, it's fun. I have a whole drawer just devoted to chopsticks and chopstick rests. Right. And I change it over about 4-5 times a year. Most people change clothes in their closets. Lots of people, not just me, but lots of people also change over their tableware.
How many pairs do you have?
Lots. I probably thousands. Probably thousands.
Wow.
Yeah. But it's fun, especially the chopstick rests. During the summer, I have wonderful little slices of watermelon that have a bite taken out of them, and that's just where the chopsticks rest, is where the bite was.
Okay.
And also I have fans that you could cool yourself off with different designs, and things made out of glass, which sort of, you can imagine ice tinkling and it cools you off. In the winter, I have lots of different mushrooms, different kinds of mushrooms. I have lots of different kinds of fish from different times
that's
of
so
year.
Fun.
Including I have some on a grill that becomes the chopstick rests.
Okay.
So sometimes when I serve the sama fish, I'll serve it with the chopstick rest as well.
Yeah, it's a lot of materials like cedar, cypress, and ivory to anything. And last time I went to Japan, I spent literally 45 minutes to pick a pair of chopsticks. There's a specialty shop.
Right.
And I realized the variation, you know, of course, how you feel in your hand, also how small the tip is.
Yes, and whether it's square or round, increasingly there are ones that are sort of square at the very end, and they're actually much easier to pick up things that might be slippery. So for noodles and things of that sort, sometimes I'll use the ones that have the edge, the very tip that's sort of square.
Right.
Also the length of them compared to the size of your hand.
Right.
They come in various different lengths.
So, by the way, you know, the holding small thing,
I
really find it most useful when I find a tiny eggshell.
Right.
And when you crack an egg, I was like, oh, my God, this is, how can I get it? Spoon never works.
Never works.
Chopsticks.
Absolutely.
In a second.
Right. Absolutely. So easy. And the other is olives in a jar without having to pour out all of the liquid. You can get into a very narrow, tall jar and just pull out the piece that you want. They're very useful.
And they say... I don't know. It's true, but that stimulates your brain.
I'd like to think so.
Right. Okay. So, anyways, so many things to talk about. But one thing you cannot miss is how to take care of Japanese tableware.
There are some pretty high maintenance items, and unless you're prepared to maintain them, you probably shouldn't. You should let other people buy them and go to their house to eat. Mm. some that require this bath before you're going to be using them, particularly ones that are unglazed or have a sort of a crackly kind mm-hmm. of glaze where there's exposed clay. And in order to make sure that the food doesn't stain the dish and that also the flavors don't come through,
right.
You do need to give them this bath in an oily, starchy liquid, and that will enable it to seal the edges so that it won't become a problem. And those kinds of dishes also obviously can't go in a dishwasher.
Right.
Very, so the very bath, hot water.
Right. The bath is basically the, you know, washed rice.
The water that's run off from washing rice, and if you don't wash a whole lot of rice and you want something else instead, I would say cornstarch and a little bit of vegetable oil in the water. Rice has natural oils in it, and it will take care of it. Others, things like lacquer, if the temperature is too dry, it will crack. And you need to be able to moisten it. And sometimes in Japan, they'll do that by putting a slice of daikon in, for example, a jubako, a lacquered jubako. When you're not using it because you don't use it every day, you would put a slice of daikon or perhaps apple or pear in there, and the natural moisture from the vegetable is enough to be able to keep the lacquer from cracking.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Other, if you make sushi and you have one of the handai, the wooden tubs, you definitely have to wet that down frequently. Or again, put it in, if you keep it too wet, mold will grow in it, but you do have to be able to monitor it. And so if you're not prepared to do that, you probably should use just an ordinary bowl, or you shouldn't be using things that require a whole lot of extra effort. But there are... also scratching up. So when I stack them in a drawer or in a shelf and a cupboard, I will often put a piece of cloth or paper in between the layers to make sure that, especially rough pottery, one does not scratch the other.
Okay. Yeah. And so this is my last question. So where can you buy Japanese tableware? I mean, it's, you know, here it's hard in the States, but if you go
anywhere.
To Japan, you can go...
Lots and lots of places. I have everything from, you know, handcrafted, and Mono Hanako, Hanako-san does wonderful stuff down in Kyushu. She's got a wonderful website. I've got a lot of her stuff. Not terribly expensive. I think very reasonable for what it is. And then I also have the 100 yen shop. And there's a lot of stuff in the 100 yen shop that can work as well.
Yeah, I even also have regular supermarkets.
Supermarkets, yeah. And I would also encourage people to look again at just your plain white round circle and think about it differently. You know, your plain white plate. Maybe you can break up that space by putting certain things in little dishes on top of it. So in other words, using it as a, almost as a tray rather than as a single platter. But there's all sorts of possibilities. I often will be sketching something out, and it's a way of helping me organize a menu at the same time.
Right. So even if you use a regular Western porcelain white dish, you can play differently in the Japanese
think
style?
Think differently, yeah. Think differently. Imagine a different way of presenting your food, and think of sort of clustering different dishes and different things together.
I tend to use Western style. So I should... think about it tonight.
Okay, good.
Right. Okay, so thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you.
All right, so and hopefully you'll be back here soon.
I hope so, yes. Indeed, we could talk about all sorts of wonderful things.
Right, so listeners, if you have any request of the topic for Elizabeth, please send us an email. It's JapaneseHeritageRadioNetwork.org and any other topic suggestions as well. So if you'd like to know more about Elizabeth's projects, please visit tasteofculture.com. That's one word, tasteofculture.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher as a podcast. And today's show is made possible by Whole Foods Market, and our engineer is Vito Harsh. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.